Welcome to the CSIS podcast, a look at the week's news and foreign policy through the eyes of the experts at the Centre for Strategic and International Studies. I'm Colin Quinn. This week, the President of South Korea, Park Geun-hye, travelled to Washington to meet with President Barack Obama, with familiar issues on the agenda: North Korea, the U.S.-Korea alliance, as well as Korea's relationship to its other powerful neighbours, Japan and China. But before she met with the U.S. president, she met with CSIS President Dr. John Hamry in a packed CSIS headquarters. We'll now hear from their Q&A with Dr. Hamry first and Madam Park's remarks translated to English following.
When you entered office, you launched a major new initiative, Trust Politik. In an effort to enhance security on the peninsula, but North Korea has regrettably not accepted it and instead has undertaken a number of destabilizing activities. In that light, what steps can the Republic of Korea and the United States take now together to enhance deterrence on the Korean peninsula?
As I'm sure all of you know, the Korean Peninsula trust-building process, just to repeat the gist of it, is about responding decisively to North Korea's provocations, but at the same time keeping the door open to dialogue, and in that process, enhancing the degree of trust between the two Koreas. And we remain committed to continuing on with this effort. And so it's about seeking to uphold stability on the Korean Peninsula. And with regard to North Korea's recent provocations inside the DMZ this August, we had, in fact, applied in its entirety this principle, the trust-building process principle, in our response to North Korea's threats and belligerence. In fact, they would engage in unspeakable acts of belligerence and threatening words, but we responded again. We pushed back very decisively, and we made sure that they realized that they would have to pay a price for whatever provocative acts that they engaged in. For instance, we made sure not to turn off the loudspeakers despite their threatening blackmailing if we were to continue to move forward with the loudspeakers. So we made sure we kept them on. And so, as a matter of fact, because we held firmly to these principles, we've seen how that firmness actually paved the way to dialogue, paradoxically, and how that dialogue in turn led to meetings that in turn led to an apology being issued on the part of North Korea, as well as agreements on other steps as well. So this, in fact, is evidence of how we've actually put to action the North Korea, the Korean Peninsula peace-building, the trust-building process. This is how we responded to North Korea's recent provocations. So I believe the recent instance shows that our response actually works. This trust-building process actually works. And all of this has been predicated on a very robust combined defense posture. And we've also made sure that there was close international unity that includes not just Korea, Japan, and the United States, but also the Chinese and the Russians. The Russians themselves have also expressed their vehement opposition to North Korea's provocations. And so this demonstrated the importance of international coordination in terms of deterring North Korean behavior. And it also impressed upon the North Koreans that the development of nuclear weapons capabilities is in fact an exercise in futility, and it really does not serve their future either. So we've sought to make them realize that point. And again, I stress the importance of international coordination and the importance of maintaining a principled stance and response, and to make sure that we seek to put an end to the vicious cycle of rewarded provocations. And this is what we plan to remain committed to as we go forward. And we also make it clear to them that should they abandon their nuclear aspirations, then there will be forthcoming economic assistance and also other development assistance that will be furnished not just by South Korea, by the Republic of Korea, but also with the international community as well. But sadly, we see apparently how they seem to have no intention whatsoever of abandoning or forswearing their nuclear aspirations, and hence our approach doesn't seem to be working as we hope. So what needs to be done is to make sure that they realize that by incurring deeper isolation upon themselves and seeing no brighter future for them, I think we need to engage in international coordination so that they realize that, so that they are left with no choice but to abandon their nuclear aspirations, and only then can they expect to see greater international support forthcoming.
Thank you, Madam President. David Maxwell over at Georgetown University wrote about unification. You talked about unification, but his question is, what are the critical obstacles that must be overcome to achieve unification? This is one of those things we know will happen, but we don't know what we have to do to overcome it. What would be your response?
Yeah. I have to say that my response to this question partially overlaps my answer to the first question. If we are to engage in discussions about unification with North Korea, it's imperative that we have a degree of principles or that the discussions be defined by principles. I say this because if we see a situation where North Korea's provocations are met with rewards and we have this ongoing vicious cycle, then the very idea of discussing the notion of unification would be lost. Even as we make sure we maintain a principled approach to North Korea on the basis of robust deterrence vis-a-vis North Korea, I also feel it's important for the people of South and North Korea to be able to restore a sense of common identity, a sense of homogeneity. This is important because after 70 years of division, especially in light of the 70 years of division that we've been suffering, and I think it's important for us to pursue greater interactions in non-political fronts, for instance, cultural and sports exchanges, as well as exchanges on the environmental front as well. And by doing so, by further promoting interactions among the South and North Korean people, we can hope to overcome the divide that has defined the peninsula and thereby restore a sense of homogeneity. So from a humanitarian perspective, we're also seeking to provide assistance to North Korea that would assist them in terms of rural development and more holistic development in their rural regions that would also in turn redound to improving the quality of life among the North Korean people. At times we see the North Koreans refusing to accept such gestures or overtures. So even when it comes to humanitarian assistance, we see how we're not able to really carry out things as we desire. And lastly, I would say that all of this is predicated on North Korea, in fact, abandoning its nuclear aspirations. As I mentioned before, it's important that they realize that pursuing nuclear weapons is an exercise in futility, and that it merely deepens their own self-isolation, and it turns their backs on the rest of the world. So again, it's very important that the international community stands united in sending the message so that they have no choice but to forego their nuclear weapons capabilities.
Madam President, Don Manzullo, Congressman Manzullo, who is the President and CEO of the Korean Economic Institute, placed this question. Both Korea and the United States are right now plagued with high unemployment and underemployment, especially with young people. Korea has the added problem that it has a very low birth rate. Can you tell us what ideas you have to address this critical problem for your country and what role, if any, the government can play in finding a solution?
I think I can point out three factors that can explain partially why we see such phenomena in Korea. The first being the ongoing continuation of a tendency of low growth in the Korean economy, which in turn lowers the ability of the economy to create jobs, more jobs. Second is the mismatch between young people that are seeking jobs and the businesses that are seeking to find and place jobs or to fill those jobs. And third is the rigidity that we see in our labor markets. In order to further create new jobs, we've also undertaken what we call the three-year plan for economic innovation, a key centerpiece of which is the Creative Economy Initiative. And through this initiative, we're seeking to transform our economic paradigm. For instance, we seek to marry ICT with existing industries, to marry culture with existing industries, and thereby promote convergence, and also thereby create and come up with new style jobs. And so we're working to bring that about. In particular, I would make mention of the service sectors, which obviously has very high potential for creating jobs. We're seeking to boldly cut red tape so that we can unleash more jobs in the services sector. And we're also calling upon our National Assembly to, again, boldly remove regulatory barriers and to also pass legislation that would allow for such deregulation in the service sector. In order to deal with the issue of mismatch that bedevils the Korean economy, we are seeking to cultivate the kind of human talent that meets the expectations and demands of society and industry, and we're working to cultivate such talent. For instance, we're seeking to pursue the dual system of learning and working, of allowing learning and working at the same time. We're also seeking to institute a national competency standard system, and so we are in fact undertaking a multiple arrays of policies to alleviate the issue of mismatch, and thereby also come up with human talent that can better cater to social needs, the broader social needs. For instance, people at that study the humanities, obviously the humanities in and of itself is a very, it's a remarkable, admirable academic pursuit, but one cannot readily land a job by studying humanities, and hence we can provide them with coding education or coding training, or also furnish them with various educational opportunities that better cater to the needs of society. And as for mitigating rigidity in our labor market, I would note that the tripartite Labor Management Government Commission has been struggling for the past few months to work out a compromise, and they have succeeded in coming up with a compromise. So once pursuant to that compromise, once the government institutes various guidelines and the National Assembly also passes the relevant legislation, I think we can be confident in looking forward to greater flexibility as well as security in our labor markets.
I have one last question, and it was submitted by Glenn Fukushima over at the Center for American Progress. He submitted it before your speech, and you spoke about tension in history issues in Northeast Asia, and he wrote about that. So let me just ask a couple of very specific things. Do you envision that there's a chance for a formal bilateral summit between you and Prime Minister Abe? And what role, if any, can the United States play to encourage closer ties between Korea and Japan?
The trilateral summit meeting among Korea, Japan, and China is slated to be held in early November, and this is being held for the first time in 3 years under the initiative of the Korean government. And the reason the Korean government had endeavored to bring that about was not only to serve the cause of peace in Northeast Asia, but because we had expectations that such a trilateral gathering would redound to improving bilateral relations within the region as well. And as for the question about holding a bilateral summit meeting with Prime Minister Abe, I do feel that I can have such a meeting with him. But in order for such a meeting to be really significant, I think it's important that the two countries be able to move towards a more future-oriented change in our relationship, if that meeting is to have real significance. The Korean people are keenly following this upcoming meeting. And for instance, I would note the issue of the comfort woman victims, which is a very important issue at the moment, outstanding issue. Most of these comfort woman victims are now nearly in their 90s. And just this year alone, we've seen nine comfort woman victims pass away, and we currently only have 47 remaining survivors. So literally, we really don't have much time in terms of dealing with this issue and making sure that we can bring closure to their pent-up agony. And so the Korean people, again, are following this issue with great interest and keen interest. And once we're able to make progress on this issue, I think it's fair to say that a meeting that does lead to progress on this issue can be characterized as a meaningful meeting.
And that was South Korean President Park Geun-hye. We'll be back with more next week. But until then, I'm Colm Quinn. Thanks for listening.